Jake is another good example. He's got a little bit of a, he gets a little bit of a bump because of his YouTube channel, and it just seems
yeah, he's got more people following his YouTube channel than we have following our podcast. He's very concise. He's very polished. It's like great visuals that go along with stuff. Like he puts a lot of work into this 4-minute thing.
It's true.
He also, he doesn't swear. You know, like his content is more palatable to a general audience, I think, than kind of the niche that we carve out for ourselves just by being crass, the times that we're crass.
And I wonder about that.
You know, when we released the Mike episode, The Unintentional Racist, there were a lot of people, especially on the Mormon Hub, you know, on Facebook, who commented that they would like to share it with family members or friends that are more mainstream Mormon, TBM, whatever you want to call it. But the content would throw them off. Jake and his wife, Erica, talked about maybe doing a version of that, making it more palatable to a Brother Jake targeted audience.
Hi, I'm Brother Jake, and today I'm here to talk about how the recent essay published by the church on LDS.org about race in the priesthood is super awesome and not problematic at all. Well, not exactly. Now, as some of you might know, I've had the pleasure to be good friends with Infants on Thrones host Glenn Ostlund, and a few weeks ago, he told me that in the wake of the podcast with Mike Tannehill about the church's recent essay on race and the priesthood, several listeners had asked for a version of the podcast that still contained the frankly excellent discussion they had while being a little more, let's say, palatable to a wider audience. So here I am with my editor-in-chief and lovely wife, Erica.
Hi.
To do just that. Most of the audio you hear is just the content of the previous podcast, with a few strategic edits, interspersed with some interjections on our end to clarify references made to little-known or obscure topics, and a bit of discussion between the two of us after the panel discussion wraps up. Anyway, let's get started.
Shall the youth of Zion falter? Will the enemy assaileth?
Shall we shrink or shun the fight?
No. True to the faith that our parents have cherished. True to the truth for which martyrs have perished. To God's command, soul, heart, and hand.
Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humans. We are the core.
Welcome back to Infants on Thrones. I'm Glenn Ostlund, and today we have a long discussion with Mike Tannehill about his views on the recent essay, Race and the Priesthood, that you can find online at LDS.org. So sit back and enjoy this highly entertaining conversation between myself, Tom Perry.
How do you not have respect for the guy making calls saying this is a bunch of garbage? Dude, I don't know. I love it.
Matt Long.
He's the only one that has the balls to say, come on now, let's embrace the doctrine.
Randy Snyder.
You know who else was like that? Hitler. He really believed in his principles.
Bob Caswell.
Can we splice in like some sort of disclaimer? By the way, whenever Negro is said, it's just Mike.
And Mike Tannehill.
It wasn't just the Negro people that had a priesthood ban.
The Unintentional Racist. So Mike's got three issues with the recent article on race, or the new position in the church on race and the priesthood. So, hey, Mike.
Yes.
Tell us what's going on with this whole race and priesthood thing.
Okay, the church put out an essay the first Friday in December, and it's entitled Race and the Priesthood. And basically it goes through and, at first blush, my just first reading it without examining anything deeply, it says that the church only had the position of withholding the priesthood from the Negro people because of they were bigoted racists and couldn't call down a revelation from heaven to change it until President Kimball was able to get a revelation. And that, to me, was just horrible. And so I just looked at it a little closer, and I've got three real issues with it. Do you want me to go through them?
Yeah.
If they're short and concise, you bet.
Okay, the first one is that they use the phrase white privilege to say that the reason for the ban was because, you know, racism, America is a racist country, blah, blah, blah. White privilege comes from what's known as critical race theory. Critical race theory comes up out of the civil rights movement, and those who didn't think the civil rights movement went far enough really wanted to ingrain the theory that white people are racist and all this into the American legal system. And so that you see the phrase white privilege popping up around to say that America's always been racist and our laws have always held black people down. This is a quote from Emory Law Professor Dorothy Brown. She says, by using things like white privilege and critical race theory, they seek to highlight the ways in which the law is not neutral and objective, but designed to support white supremacy and subordination of people of color in America. And this whole theory that's, you know, it's coming up through the colleges and through the police systems across America that we're racist and we should all be ashamed of ourselves for our heritage and do what we can to help black people. And for that to be in a church publication, the phrase white privilege is just outrageous. It's a political liberal terminology. If you look at the ones that built up critical race theory, they're radicals. And for them to use that in church publication says something about the authors. Now, the First Presidency did not write the essay. They had a committee do it. And they just kind of signed off on these essays. And I don't think they understood that was in there. But once you see that it's in there, it peppers the entire essay.
So why does it bother you that white privilege is in there, that it's a political word?
It's a totally political word. It's a radical thing. And it has no business in a church publication.
So if you were to, let's say they said, okay, Brother Tannehill, why don't you rewrite it for us? How would you frame it? What would be your solution to that?
That's my point number three.
Okay.
Number two.
Yeah.
Is that towards the end of the essay, they're dismissive. They say they disavow all theories, how do they phrase it, regarding all the different things about black people that came up in the Mormon church until the ban came along. The problem is they mention some things that aren't theories, they're actually doctrines. Like they mention that the darkening of skin color is a theory. But How many verses in Scripture can you name, especially in the Book of Mormon, that spells out it's not a theory, God did that?
Right.
There's Moses 7:22.
And they were a mixture of all the seed of Adam, save it were the seed of Cain. For the seed of Cain were black and had not place among them.
Abraham 1:27.
Now Pharaoh, being of that lineage which could not have the right of the priesthood, notwithstanding the Pharaohs would fain claim of it from Noah.
2 Nephi 5:21.
And he had caused the cursing to come upon them, yea, even a sore cursing because of their iniquity. For behold, they had hardened their hearts against him, and they had become like unto a flint. Wherefore, as they were white and exceedingly fair and delightsome, that they might not be enticing unto my people, the Lord God did cause a skin of blackness to come upon them.
3 Nephi 2:15.
And their curse was taken from them, and their skin became white like unto the Nephites.
Alma 3:6-9.
And the skins of the Lamanites were dark, according to the mark which was set upon their fathers, which was a curse upon them because of their transgression and their rebellion against their brethren.
And then they talk about the theory that they couldn't marry into the Negro race, that members of the church shouldn't marry. Now, that had to do, it was a general ban in the church members to not marry outside the priesthood, Negro or otherwise. But if the Negroes didn't have the priesthood, that's what the ban was there for.
Well,
you're supposed
to
marry someone who has the priesthood.
Okay, but I mean, I think they're two separate issues, aren't they? I mean, yeah, they were encouraged to marry within the priesthood or whatever. But I think there was this emphasis on the racism thing, I think. That's the interpretation I get.
No, that ties into Moses 8 that says the reason the flood came about is because all the church members married outside the church and everyone became wicked.
No, there were church leaders that made specific references to race.
They did.
So
they did.
So it was. So it wasn't necessarily about, well, make sure that he's a priesthood holder.
Well, yeah.
I think you're using that as kind of a straw man there. You're saying,
if none of the Negroes could hold a priesthood, then you don't marry any Negroes, correct? Until the ban was lifted, and then they don't care anymore.
So you're saying they use that as like a cover? Like they're saying,
well, it's just to say these things are theories and disavow the theories and then name off things that are canonized scripture. You can't do that.
Well, what?
Disavow canon. And the third one is Tom touched on, is that there is doctrine behind priesthood bans. It wasn't just the Negro people that had a priesthood ban. You remember the Levites could only officiate in certain things. There were very few actual Melchizedek priesthood holders.
Okay. You know,
God comes down from the mountain and wipes out the priesthood from among the general Israelite population.
So what does that have to do with what? Okay, so there was. Okay, we can we go ahead and say, okay, fine. What does that have to do with the racism ban, though?
I don't understand. If he can limit it to just the Levites, he can limit it to just the non-darkies.
It has to do with family lines.
It's more complex. Okay.
Okay. You notice, you remember the Jacob's allegory of the olive trees, where he's quoting an older Book of Mormon prophet that we don't have. I think it's Zezram.
Zenos, the lawyer, Zenos and Zenic
had the allegory of the olive trees. What do the trees in the garden represent?
The house of Israel.
Okay, one is the house of Israel,
and the other is the Gentiles.
And the other family trees,
and the wickedness,
and some of them are tended to.
There's grafting.
Okay, and so the grafting represents when they bring in the Gentiles into the priesthood line, which doesn't happen. Remember, Christ wouldn't teach Gentiles during his lifetime. It was only after he died, he sent a revelation to Peter. Okay, now you can bring the Gentiles in. It's just families come into the priesthood at different times, and that God distributes his authority as he sees fit. If he didn't do it to the Negroes, so 78, then that's his option.
So God sees fit, then, right? I mean,
The way that we've talked about the Book of Mormon before is being an example of pseudepigrapha, where Joseph Smith is assuming the voice of ancient prophets, and in this case, it's an ancient prophet who never actually existed. And so we've got a brand new allegory that's conveniently explaining how a branch of Gentiles, like Joseph Smith and the early saints, could be grafted into the pure and original priesthood that came from Israel. So it's this really convenient pseudepigraphical explanation that justifies this whole Mormon movement.
Wait, Gentiles being brought in is a New Testament thing. It's not a Joseph Smith thing.
Well, okay, I'm not saying he came up with the idea, but he's the one that created the Zenos character and gave it that weight in the Book of Mormon. That's my assertion.
I think the funniest thing about this is that the mortal Jesus was a racist, but the resurrected Jesus was not. So...
You got to replace the word racism with families. All right.
I'm calling a spade a spade, man.
Right. Funny. The thing that interests me the most about what's going on. Come on, guys. The thing that interests me the most about this is the way that Mike is taking on the church. You know that, Mike, you've been called an apostate by
you.
Well, not by I've been doing that for a long time, but I mean the who was it? The church committee? So talk about who you've talked to, who you've raised these issues with, and what those conversations have been like.
All right. The thing was popping up on my screen for over the weekend, and I just ignored it. And then I'm like, okay, I'll read this thing. And so the night I read it, I went to my bishop and I'm saying, you got to read this. This is absolute garbage. And they can't have this up on the LDS website. This is wrong. This is faith destroying. It's heresy. And so I got them to read it, and I talked to them on the following Sunday, and they agreed with me, yeah, it's crap.
Bishop agreed that it was crap?
Yeah, he's like, oh, what a bunch of garbage.
He agreed with all three of your points about it?
To my memory, yeah, he did.
Okay.
So I couldn't get a hold of my steak because things were – it was over the holidays, really. But I did – as soon as the holidays were over, like first week of January, I called my 70. And I called him and said, can you read this and look at these things? He said, sure. He called my 70, called me back that night, and we went over him. He sees wiggle room with the thing where it says theories. And I'm like, they can't play with speech like that.
He's a 70, Mike.
But he saw my points.
But he made wiggle room, though. He essentially said, oh, come on, Mike.
Well, he said, this is from the brethren. You know,
yeah.
The brethren signed off on it. It signed off on.
Well, because, I mean, I guess that they would be expecting that you would sustain the brethren. And here you're challenging them, and you're saying that this is heresy that they came up with and put on their LDS.org website.
But the brethren did not write this. They had a committee write it. And
but
who
they
knows?
Approved it, though.
Do they write anything, Mike? Mike, when was the last time the brethren wrote anything, like since like Joseph Fielding Smith? It's been by committee forever.
They write their toxic conference.
Really? I don't think so.
They're heavily what's the word I'm looking for?
Unless you're Packer.
Redacted by a committee.
I'll say what I want if you're Packer. But I just Googled LDS.org and looked for intellectual reserve, I think is what they're called.
Right.
And I called their headquarters and talked to a couple people there. He says, we're getting flooded with calls over this same essay. He says, I don't like it either, is what the guy told me. And so I called, I found out through them that it's the church history department had to do with this because it's a church history project. They're releasing a whole bunch of essays over these topics. And what they've done is they just sent out to a bunch of intellectuals to pool together and write these essays.
My theory here is that everyone's playing each other because it seems like every time you've told me how somebody feels about it, they're giving you like the diplomatic answer of like, oh yeah, I agree with you, but my hands are tied. And then you call somebody up, oh yeah, I agree with you, but my hands are tied. And like, I think it's just that most people have a certain sense of apathy when it comes to the church having to comply with modern standards of civic sort of things, and they just do this over and over again, and you're the only one who's like, hang on, guys, back the truck up. What are we doing?
But, Mike, didn't you get into kind of a yelling match with one of these guys from one of these intellectuals?
Yeah, I two of the higher-ups at Church History Department, one guy was Tom, and I think the other guy was Craig or something. I can't remember exactly. But they're like, well, you got to support the brethren. You can't just, and I'm like, wait a minute. White privilege is a political term. You can't use that in church publication. And he tried to tell me it's not a political term. But if you, a simple Google will tell you who wrote critical race theory, where it came from, the radical organizations they spin off of. You know, white privilege is just another way of saying critical race theory. And he's trying to tell me it's not a political term. And I'm like, also, what am I supposed to do? Rip Alma chapter 3 out of my scriptures? Alma chapter 3 directly defies your essay.
And he agreed with you. Is that right? He agreed with you.
He did. He said, you go ahead and rip that out. Just he was laughing as he said it. But it was heated at that point, we're just screaming at each other over the phone.
Incidentally, did anyone else grow up in the Mormon church with seminary teachers recommending that you staple Songs of Solomon shut in the Bible because it's useless and it's kind of apocryphal and it's not?
My mission president said just rip it out.
Yeah, see? So it's not like this is unprecedented. It's just the Book of Mormon instead of the Bible.
But okay, Mike, I got to ask you, so it sounds to me like the conversation turned from this race issue into criticizing the brethren issue, because it sounds like every time you'd run into somebody, they said, you got to obey the brethren.
That's exactly right. The two up in the upset history department were like that. They're like, you can't defy the brethren.
So, Mike,
DNC, whether it come from my mouth or from my servants, it is the same.
Here's what I love about this. Mike is me in 2007 when Prop 8 and Prop 102 in Arizona came out when I said, the brethren are wrong. Yeah. This is wrong.
Yeah. I've got scripture to back up my position.
But you're doing the same thing. You had the same reaction. What you're saying is your personal stance on morality or doctrine is different than the brethren, so you're going to go with your own. So good for you,
well,
Mike.
But Mike's not saying it's his personal. He's saying that this is church doctrine. This is what's being swept away.
Well, the one guy that I talked to, the author, and I mentioned the white privilege thing, he knew exactly what I was talking about. And he said, well, what do you mean? It's not just a theory. White privilege is real. And you're going, what the hell are you talking about? This is a radical liberal ideology theory that's being pushed, and you're trying to use it to back up your stance on this church history essay?
So, Mike,
you can't say those things.
So after you talked with these guys at the history department, then you talked with your stake president, right?
I talked to one of his counselors because he was out of town.
Okay. And how did that go?
He said, well, I didn't get that when I read it. And I said, well, go back and look for these things. And I haven't talked to him about it since then, but he knows what I'm doing. And I got 2/3 of my letter to the presidency written. It's a rough draft. I got to edit it and write the last part. And then I'm hoping what I want to do is go to my bishop and my stake and my 70 and have them just say, please look at what he's saying. You know, not that we agree with him, but just please review these things so that when it appears before the 12, it's not just some yucko in the stick sending him a letter.
Mike, I have a question. If they don't change their stance on this, would you leave the church?
No, I just won't sustain the essay. Well, you know, it's the essay that's wrong, and I don't know which.
So
of the 12 proved
you'll,
it.
You'll become a cafeteria Mormon.
Oh. Okay, so Mike, you know, let's see, how old are you now?
42.
So in 30 years, when you're 72, and the church accepts gay marriage, maybe not in the temple, but just accepts gay marriage. I mean, Mike, you should have seen the writing on the wall. I mean, the church has loosened its stance on birth control, on women's rights, on, you know, blacks in the priesthood. The church changes with social, you know, outside social pressures. It's just the way it's been. You know, polygamy. They should.
I have
it
on good authority that the 12 have pounded the pulpit that gay marriage is never going to be accepted.
Yeah, and they'll be dead. They'll be dead
until they die.
All of them will be dead in 30 years, Mike, and you'll be 72.
Holland accepting it.
Holland will be dead in less like 10 years.
But I mean, I don't know if that's going to happen or not. But you certainly had apostles pounding the pulpit about race and the priesthood
and birth control. It wasn't that long ago that apostles and oral sex is no longer taboo in the Mormon Church.
I got a copy of that Kimball letter. I got it on my computer.
Yeah, but they don't touch it now.
So, Mike, is this the first time for you, or what's different? Like, because Randy just listed, like, literally five examples that, for me, are, like, practically the same thing. But for you, this is the one that's setting you off, but all the other ones are okay?
I sustain the brethren on their stance on gay marriage.
Well, I think the difference is this one's
what
happening.
What about on oral sex?
This one's happening on Mike's clock. It's like when he's in the prime of his life, and he's been used to it for 42 years, and now it's like, what just happened? Whereas in the past, like, you just read about all the stuff about oral sex and birth control. That was before your time, and then you just sort of, you know, buy off, sign off on it because it's not your problem. It's that you didn't have to deal with it front and center like this one. Is that what it is?
I just, this one's so obviously in your face wrong that, you know, what else can you do?
Because you're so used to it the right way. But the other ones, you were never used to it the right way. It was just history books.
So what do you think is going on, Mike? I mean, do you think the church is or this committee is trying to popularize the church or, you know, liberalize or make it more progressive? I mean, what's happening here? Is there something
it's hard to say? I don't know what the approval process was. I don't know how much of this they read, or, you know, did they all sit in a circle and read it as the 12 and read this essay and say, "Okay, cool. We'll all sign off on this." Or was it just, you know, one of the guys at the end of the night on his way out the door, "Hey, can you sign off on the essays the history department put out?" "Oh, sure." You know,
from what I understand is if they give approval, it doesn't matter whether it's short term or if they're just like, "Oh, you need a signature, I'll sign it." The Lord is inspiring them. And wouldn't the Lord
No,
actually...
it doesn't work that way. The 12 don't stand around in a deluge of revelation all day long.
But if they're approving something that's important that has their stamp of approval, you think the Lord's gonna be like, "Nah, I'll just let that one slide. I won't intervene there."
He'll strike them dead.
But isn't this race and the priesthood clarification on LDS.org part of a larger series of the church addressing problematic issues? I mean, isn't there one on polygamy, and there's one they're adding other ones? So I mean,
first
what
vision.
Is this? Yeah, so, yeah, they did the multiple versions of the first vision. So what's happening? Are they just trying to placate the masses? How do you see this movement in general, Mike?
Well, they've been doing a lot of stuff with the history department. They're putting out like everything Joseph Smith ever wrote and big deluxe format. And, you know, there's all this history stuff coming out because they got like an army down there digging through the archives, finding fascinating things.
Because it turns out Google isn't going away. And people, I don't mean to be, you know, snide Lib. About it. It's people are finding it, and the kids in particular, youth, you know, I call it the generation under ours, but it's not my kids. It's kind of the space between me and my kids. Those guys who are now kind of going on missions are finding this stuff, and it's destroying them. The number of kids that are leaving the church that from my home ward, I mean, are almost everyone but one of a certain generation have, and it's because of this. And so I think it's really more about being pragmatic, and they're also losing converts with this.
What makes me want to cry?
So when somebody, you know, when somebody gets some missionaries at their door, they teach them the first discussion, then they go online and Google, and they're done.
Right.
What made me want to cry is one of those kids looking up race in the priesthood and saying, oh, they can never call down a revelation because they were all racist bigots, not until Kimball. Oh, what kind of church is this? Because that's what
it's saying. But you're right, Mike. You are 100% right, and that's what I said when I read it. I had a friend of mine who's a former bishop who is a member of the High Council came to me and said, You know about this stuff seems like more than I do. Doesn't this say that they're all just racist bigots and they didn't have revelation then? I said, that's how I wrote it. So I'm interested that a former bishop and current High Council member read it the same way. So you're absolutely right, Mike.
Now, I know for a fact McKay could receive revelation. How many testimonies did his secretary have where he'd come back from the temple about praying about a new apostle, and his face glowed like Moses was a testimony? You know, McKay could get an answer from the Lord when he wanted one. And well, he prayed over this very issue multiple times.
How do you know? You're giving an example that's unfalsifiable. He picked the right guy? How do we even know that? You're saying that's proof that he gets revelation.
The people that worked with him is that his face glowed like Moses when he got back from the temple for praying about an apostle to call. Well, all I'm saying is to say that the actual essay says he got no answer when he prayed about it.
But Hubie Brown did, and it turns out Hubie Brown was right.
So a little background on Hubie Brown. In 1969, he was first counselor to David O. McKay, and he was in favor of reversing the priesthood ban, but the measure didn't end up passing the vote within the 12 apostles and first presidency. Mostly, people speculate because of involvement from Harold B. Lee.
No, Hubie Brown is
everything.
But so, Mike, you think that McKay and others did get the answer, and the answer was
not now.
God was saying, it's not time yet. Just be patient.
Right. And the number, I mean, McKay and,
your assertion, Mike, right, is that ban on the priesthood wasn't about racism as part of the culture that these men were living in, that it was really God who was holding it for his own wisdom.
That's why I say you got to replace the word race with family, and it makes perfect sense and lines up with the Abrahamic covenant and all these other things.
What about the Brazilians?
What about
yeah.
To clarify on the comments about Brazil, here's a passage from the essay itself. Brazil, in particular, presented many challenges. Unlike the United States and South Africa, where legal and de facto racism led to deeply segregated societies, Brazil prided itself in its open, integrated, and mixed racial heritage. In 1975, the church announced that a temple would be built in Sao Paulo, Brazil. As temple reconstruction proceeded, church authorities encountered faithful black and mixed ancestry Mormons who had contributed financially and in other ways to the building of the Sao Paulo Temple, a sanctuary they realized they would never be allowed to enter once it was completed. Their sacrifices, as well as the conversions of thousands of Nigerians and Ghanaians in the 1960s and early 1970s, moved church leaders.
Initially, Brazilians were out, but then it turned out that, well, we've already kind of started down this road, and so we're going to come up with this arbitrary 1/16th on your father's side because it was the cat was already out of the bag. The toothpaste was out. So, I mean, they had that principle. They had that. They applied that at one point and then said, meh.
But I know there's a big issue with the Cubans as well. I know there's a letter sent to the presidency about the Cubans, and there was a big to-do back in the day when they wanted to take the gospel into Cuba.
So Mike, why was God withholding it from the families, and family is better than race?
Well, what is the blessing of the Abrahamic covenant to a married couple?
Don't play that game. Just tell us.
This applies because the blessing is that your children will always either hold the priesthood or have it made available to them. The opposite of that, which is the curse, is that you're cut off. They refer to them in the scriptures as the people of the half-empty baskets because they're not going to be able to pick any fruit from the tree.
You see what I'm saying? There's no blessings of the gospel in their family.
So they, is the atonement of Christ then dead for those people because they didn't have...
No, like, the priesthood can actually become a curse if you have the priesthood and then you don't live up to the responsibilities. All the blessings of the priesthood are reversed.
Also, the dark-skinned people weren't ready to live up to it yet.
The culture they lived in would not sustain a righteous person. Just like in the days of Noah, God had to...
They're in America. Black people were in America in the
60s. About Africa?
I don't really want
Africa
to go down
this
path.
Africa this day is full of warlords. This goes back to the days of Noah.
Yeah.
That doesn't even make sense. That doesn't even matter.
All right, go ahead, Matt.
To be doctrinal, don't you have to... So is your premise that you attribute the curse to Ham? Is that your... Well,
you got your scriptures handy? This is a Mormon podcast, right? You should all have your scriptures next to your microphones.
I usually have it on my iPad. No, this is good. I like this. I want to do this.
Moses 7:22.
Are we talking about Egyptus and Egyptus?
No, this is goes back to... it actually ties into that. And Enoch also beheld the residue of the people, which were the sons of Adam, and they were a mixture of all the seed of Adam, save it were the seed of Cain, for the seed of Cain were black and had not place among them. All right, and Noah's son married one of the daughters of Cain, which brought the skin through.
Who was Egyptus?
But the curse came because Ham tried to steal the priesthood from his father.
I got a really important question, Mike.
Okay.
What changed in Africa from the time of McKay in the 60s to 1978 that made them ready?
Because the civil rights movement had happened, and they were all fully accepted as...
You mean the civil rights movement that the Brethren fought tooth and nail against, saying it was a communist
tool,
plot?
It was a tool of the communists.
Yes, it was a communist plot to overthrow
capitalism. I remember hearing about that.
What? Have you heard of F. Benson, Harold B. Lee, and...
Benson, Lee...
And there was someone else.
Joseph Fielding Smith. Harold B. Lee and Joseph Fielding Smith, the two that came after David O. McKay.
And Bruce R. McConkie.
Yeah.
All right.
Wasn't it that Stanford refused to play BYU in football? And that's what ultimately...
I think that had more to do with it than Abraham Covenant.
So a little background on this whole Stanford thing. In 1970, both Stanford and San Jose State refused to play BYU in football for being a racist organization.
But the funny thing is that Mormons like Mike can now rewrite history and say the civil rights movement was a good thing when all of their heroes fought against it. Hey, Mike, is this your last appearance on Infants?
I'm happy to show up whenever you want me.
Aw. So I have a question for you, Mike. How did it work, or how does it work, if blacks and whites are segregated because God wanted it that way? How does he define blacks and whites? Like, do you have a formula? Is there an accurate, like... You know, is it 1/16? Is it mother side, father side? Where's the magic thing? Where is it documented? Because we're talking about it as if like there's two races in the world, and really like everyone's just brown here. So
yeah,
what about the
Romanian and Bulgarian gypsies? Where do they fall down?
Now this is where you actually apply McConkie's quote that it doesn't matter anymore properly. Is that since that time there's no priesthood restriction and you can marry however you want to marry. It doesn't matter.
But it did matter back then.
It did matter then because they did not have the priesthood, and you have to have
like
the priesthood
Jedi
in your
mind
family.
Trick. That's a Jedi mind trick. There's nothing to see here. Everything's fine, and nothing matters.
They're misquoting McConkie in the essay. They stumble and stupidly use his phrase. They don't quote him. They don't use his name, but they're saying the same thing, but they're twisting it in a way that's improper.
But was that ever a formula? Was there ever a magic formula? Because nobody in their right mind believes that there are pure white and pure black people, and if there are, it's like an anomaly. It's a minority. Like, there's always some white and some black in everyone. So, like, where does that leave everyone? Is there how do you document this for all those cases where it's mixed when this was actually happening?
I have no idea.
Okay.
It'll all make sense in the millennium.
It's just like temple work. It's like it doesn't make any sense, but it will someday.
Okay.
Like,
well, even though they never had the priesthood, they're judged according to what they did with the light of Christ that was in them. And
let me ask this. If it's about priesthood and it's always about priesthood, then why were black females not allowed to participate in the temple?
I remember that.
That's a great question.
That was the one that she actually crossed the plains from Nauvoo and came to Salt Lake and said,
No. Not just her. I'm saying black women were not allowed to participate in the temple. That happened in conjunction with the priesthood. And they keep talking about a priesthood ban. And that suggests, though, that it was more than that. It was a racist doctrine. It was a racist practice, rather. So why do we keep focusing on the priesthood? If that's true, how do we reconcile
that? Because their ordinances of the priesthood. Well, I guess they could be baptized, but they couldn't be exalted. When you go through the temple and you go through the endowment session, you're talking about doing work to make you exalted. And so they were cut off from that.
So let me continue this out. You'd agree with me doctrinally. Those that are baptized but are not sealed do have a certain role in heaven. You'd agree with that, wouldn't you?
Right. Mormon theology really has no hell. We have outer darkness and three heavens.
No. But if you're baptized and if you're actually valiant and you're saved to the point where you are baptized but not not sealed, you have a certain role to those who are sealed. That's true, isn't it, Mike?
You are. Yeah. Is that in D&C 76?
132.
Your servants unto the Most High.
So for those of you that don't have all of your scriptures memorized, this is 132, 16, and 17 when they're talking about, when it's referring to people who do not marry in the sealing covenant and don't have all of the ordinances. Verse 16, therefore, when they are out of the world, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are appointed angels in heaven, which angels are ministering servants to minister for those who are worthy of a far more and exceeding and an eternal weight of glory. For these angels did not abide my law, therefore they cannot be enlarged, but remain separately and singly, without exaltation, in their saved condition to all eternity. And from henceforth are not gods, but are angels of God forever and ever.
Is that what these men were trying to create, then?
Well, anybody that is not exalted becomes a servant. I mean,
ouch! Damn. So this now becomes even more racist than I originally thought.
It doesn't just happen to the Negro people; it happens to everyone. If you're not exalted, you become a servant.
But they don't even have an opportunity.
It's if you don't enter into the new and everlasting covenant.
Correct.
Ouch.
Section 132.
That's everyone, just blacks.
What about the pre-existence? Like, are those that are 1/16th black? Is it directly proportional? like, were you 1/16th less valiant in the is it a 1-to-1 ratio?
No. That is actually, when they refer to that as a theory in the essay, they're correct, because you can only tie that to two scriptures, and one is in Abraham when he talks about the way he phrases it, to noble and great ones. So sure. You know, if there were noble and great ones, there were less noble and great ones. That makes sense. Then you tie that into D&C, I want to say it's in 88, where it talks about like clings to like, and he goes in through like five verses about how equal things cling together and stay together until everything's given a law. So
right.
you can assume that groups of people clung together, and that's how family groups came to earth.
Yeah.
Whatever group you most associated with and were most like stayed together. And so they're making an assumption based on those scriptures that if they were cut off from the priesthood, that must be how they all were in the pre-existence.
And so that's not racist?
It's a theory. I mean, that applies to, that's not just the Negroes, that's all people. That's all family lines. You can't just say it's just them.
So is there any other, are other... Give me some more examples of other races that are in this same category. Because you keep trying to generalize it away as if, like, you would say family instead.
Anything you can say about Negroes in 1978, you can say about Gentiles at the time of Peter when he received his revelation. Because all the Gentiles from Noah to Peter were cut off.
Well, that's not true, because they're this hybrid. It's not like, no, you can't teach them. If that was the case, then your analogy would make sense. But this is this hybrid of, yes, you can baptize them, yes, they can be in the church, but what they can't have is this peace, which grants some sort of part of our hierarchy, part of the authority to make them really equal with everyone else. And that's what makes it racist, Mike. It's that your analogy is just false.
Right, it's not like, it's like you can get partway there. It's like, you know, there was a huge portion of the church's history where they could participate, but only in certain specific ways. And it's the old school model of the Gentiles was all or nothing, right? It's like, don't even talk to them, don't even teach them. So what is this middle ground that is racism that isn't the Gentile model.
Well, I know, in America, they could get baptized, but in Africa, they wouldn't even send people to go baptize them, would they? Am I wrong in that, or am I correct in how I'm remembering that?
Well, I want to go back to what you said, though, about the time of the Gentiles and with Peter, because even at that time, a certain tribe of Israel had the priesthood? The priesthood wasn't available to every Jew.
The higher priesthood, yeah. The lesser priesthood was among the Levites, and there were a few high priests, but, yeah, in general, they couldn't.
So you weren't even talking about a priesthood ban there.
Well, it was a partial priesthood ban. They were cut off from the higher priesthood.
Well, they were just cut off from everything.
No, DNC 84 gets into it.
Whatever.
I can tell you, my dad served his mission in Mexico City from 1960 to 1962, and he did have a directive that if he came across a black person that he just don't even bother teaching them. And it wasn't because there was an all or nothing. It was that they just didn't want to have to deal with finding out how much black was in that person. And I got to tell you, my dad did not have a racist bone in his body, and he hated this doctrine all the way up until 1978 when he celebrated.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a huge relief when it went through. Everybody was very excited.
Yeah, because they were finally like, oh, my God isn't more racist than me. Finally. But even keeping to Mike's assumption that racism matters and it's bigger and it's not racism and it's families and we convolute the definition and expand it and make it all lovely, white, and delightsome, why does it matter? Maybe we don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but I just want to know from Mike's perspective, why does God care about, like, why is that part of the plan that he has all these different groups of people that are different colors and have different blood, and then therefore they have different critical paths to get back to heaven? And actually now in the 20th and 21st century, it doesn't matter anymore, but it did really in the past. And like, why does that have, what does that have to do with anything? Why is that part of the plan of salvation? Like the rest of it, I get the Mormon plan of salvation. It, you know, logistically, I can see how it could make sense to some people, but this whole like, different races at different points of time. Like, what is God thinking? What's the deal?
Well, way back when, the world was a lot smaller place, and you're dealing with family groups and tribes, and you're trying to preserve one to be holy and sanctified.
Why? Who cares?
It's the plan of salvation.
But these black people were integrated into Western culture long before 1978. Right. Right. Why did it take until 1978 for them to say, now they're ready?
Well, you get into like a...
How long, Mike, how long do you think the sanctity of these family groups was preserved before God threw in the towel and he's like, they're all intermingling?
In the Old Testament. You see in the Old Testament where they go wicked and he drives them off and the ten tribes are scattered.
It's called less than one generation, man. It's like, if that was his plan, like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, why would he have a plan that you needed sanctified, pure family groups to link back in a chain, but separate from each other, but they all are on the earth? Like, what is that? Like, what? Why? What does that have to do with anything? How does that factor into the plan of salvation on a personal level for you and me and for individuals going back to heaven? Why does that matter?
Well, I can tell you that if your ancestors were members of the church, they have rights to call on in the Abrahamic covenant for you to be blessed and put in positions of authority to challenge you and make you to grow. And I mean, just look, for example, in the Book of Mormon story. The Lamanites were cursed. They wipe out the Nephites, who were the righteous. And then so God makes it so that the Gentiles come and wipe them out. And then they're blessed with Christianity here in America.
But doesn't that go against one of the articles of faith that children won't be punished for the sins of their parents?
No, because that article of faith only is just dealing with infant baptism and how the Catholics say if your baby's not baptized, he's going to hell because of the fall.
Oh, here's the second article of faith. We believe that all men will be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression.
That's what that was about. But God,
to me, it says
the entire scriptural canon talks about how God deals with families, and some are cursed and some are blessed. That's everything you read in the scriptures is talking about.
That's right. That's profoundly unjust.
It does make sense.
It talks about it like as a document that we accept as an aggregate form of historical things that might have happened. But like, What does that have to do with doctrinal? Like, I don't think, even as an active believing Mormon before I left the church, Mike, like the Abrahamic covenant and what tribe was this? Like, it just, even then, I just brushed it aside because I had no idea. There was like no relevancy at all. Like, it didn't make any sense. It was just a relic of the past. And I still, to this day, have never understood why it matters, because it's not practical in any sense of how the plan of salvation works.
Well, it's to me, it did matter, Bob, but I had like the Elder Price complex.
The Elder Price that Glenn is referencing is the main missionary character in the Book of Mormon musical.
I knew that I was destined for incredible things.
Changed all of mankind, my best friend.
And that I had come through an incredible bloodline with incredible blessings, and that, you know, I was of the tribe of Ephraim, which meant God had chosen me and put me in this, you know, like Mike referenced earlier in the Book of Abraham, the noble and great ones and the pre-existence, preordained to be a light unto the entire world and to raise everyone else up out of the dust.
Why can't I be as eloquent as you, Glenn?
Seriously.
I love it, Glenn.
That was beautiful. That was like that whole elitist, and we've had this argument before, Mike, that the elitist view that made me feel special and better than everybody else, that I started looking at and going, whoa, I don't want to be that douchebag. Once I started realizing that, I'm like, that is so douchey. I don't like that.
That's because if you're part of that covenant, you're the worker. You're the one that has to go out and do the work and do the job and bring the light of the gospel to people and bring them into the covenant.
But anybody can be part of the covenant. It doesn't matter anymore. Like, it's not a prerequisite to do anything.
And the reason why is because that blood of Ephraim got scattered amongst all the people, and so they fell under the power of the covenant.
It's a way of making you feel special. If you can trace your blood back to these noble, great, you know, I mean, people do it now with Ancestry, where they're like, oh, I paid $25 to who's who in my ancestry and found out that I'm related to Charlemagne.
Yeah, but that's convoluting two things. Like, one thing is, I'm proud of my ancestry and look what my ancestors did. But then it's taking it to a whole other level when it's like, therefore, this is justification for God's almighty wisdom of segregation and bringing people. Like, it still doesn't. I mean, Glenn's argument only makes sense if we just admit that this is all man-made and it's just a self-reflection of man's preoccupation with himself.
But it's not the entire scriptural canon, Bible, Book of Mormon, Doctrine and Covenants, is all about this thing. And this is my point number three, is that by writing this essay and putting out the crap that's in it, they've missed a huge teaching moment. The fact that we're having this conversation is because this hasn't been taught clearly enough, and they missed a huge opportunity here to explain, you know, that God operates through families, and there's a reason and a purpose behind priesthood bands and priesthood blessings, and this is a teaching moment, and they blew it.
Yeah, well, that's because
they would have lost converts if they take that position, Mike. They lose converts.
This ties in directly when Moroni appeared in Joseph Smith's bedroom. He says, "Now is the time of Elijah, where the turn the hearts of the fathers to children, the children of the fathers." That's what all this is about. This title page of the Book of Mormon, to remind the house of Israel who their fathers were and the promises made to them, so they can take hold of them and operate through that priesthood that's in their lineage that they have a right to.
But nowadays, nobody has a right to anything based on their lineage. Like, that is such an antiquated, like, nobody adheres to that.
To
Mormonism,
you?
Not just to me, to anyone in affiliated with Mormonism. There's no relevance to, you know, everybody gets...
That's a pretty sweeping statement, Bob.
Really?
You're baptized, yeah. you get a patriarchal blessing, and you find out what your job is.
Okay, so... Patriarchal blessing is optional for one, and for two, let's say you get that piece of information in it that says you're part of the tribe that everyone else is a part of, Ephraim. What does that mean? It means nothing. It doesn't change how you act as a Mormon day to day.
More importantly, those who have been identified as the other tribes, what do they do differently than what everybody that's Ephraim does?
Right.
Nothing.
No, that actually, you're going to find in the Old Testament manuals this area in your Sunday school, if you go, that there's a whole lesson on what the different tribes' jobs are.
That's
our problem is we're not going.
I have a lot of friends who were Manasseh because they were islanders, and there was some patriarch at some point believed that they had to identify them as Manasseh. Notwithstanding that other people were also identified as Ephraim, but what's the job that the Manasseh tribe does versus different than
I'd
what
have
we
to look
do?
It up. I got a book around here that has it in it.
But Mike, if it's so important to God to have this family lineage, name one time in your life where you've talked to somebody, like you should have it on the tip of your tongue. This person, my ward, is this tribe and he does this. This person is this tribe and he does that. You don't know the tribe of anybody. You barely know the tribe of yourself, probably, and your wife.
We're Ephraim.
Ephraim. Okay.
Like everyone else.
Exactly. Like, what does it matter? Like, if that's the structure of God's church and it's the same as it was back then, as it is today, all that good stuff, like, where is the significance? Where is that in the day-to-day operational, everybody has a different job to do because of their tribe sort of thing? I don't see it at all.
Well, Ephraim's job is to proclaim the gospel and bring them into the covenant.
That's the job of everyone in the church. There's nothing that says, you're a part of Manasseh, you don't need to go on a mission, you don't need to proselyte, you're done.
Every member a missionary.
Yeah. It's all one tribe, Mike. There's no like significance to families in that way. Like, it doesn't. I'm just still struggling with why this mattered. Other than
I'm reticent to say, though, with the certainty that you have, Bob, that this is a non-issue for every single person in the church. I think there are. And I don't have any evidence of this except for Mike, but I think there are people in the church who do know what the different roles are. I know I did at one point, and I was really interested in, I had a companion on my mission who was of the tribe of Judah, and he was Japanese, and what did that mean? You know, it had all this meaning about the Japanese being the lost tribes of Israel to me.
But it had no meaning, because you can't remember how anything changed. Like, do you have an example of how, did you figure it out?
No. Like if he thought, okay, I have a different role in the church, I don't have to go on a mission because only Ephraim are missionaries, I mean, I don't think that it has that significant of a role, but as far as like his personal view of where he fits in God's plan, I think there's things out there like in the blessing that Jacob gave to each one of his sons, that I think that's Genesis somewhere, that you could go and read what he gave to each one of his sons. So if you're told in your patriarchal blessing that you're Manasseh or Benjamin or Judah, and then you go and you read that, then you've got, okay, this is who I am. This is the special mission. And like, so to think that nobody does that in the church and it has a personal meaning to them, I can imagine that people would, because I know that I did.
No, you're right. I remember firmly believing that if anyone who was found to be the tribe of Levi would automatically become bishop. And I don't know where – there must be some source for that, but I remember believing that strongly. So you're right, at least to a degree.
Yeah.
And the ultimate goal is to have that patriarchal line and say – because I'm tied to him, like the reason so many people remember the brethren in the early days of the church would be sealed to each other, because if one is, becomes the great patriarch and is exalted, because if they're tied to him, at least they get to be a servant in that household. At least it's these family ties and bonds that tie you to a household of exaltation. If you have the name of Christ on you, you get the blessings of Christ. If you get the name of this. You know, the goal is for your family name to be tied to exaltation, and all those tied to you get to go with you.
I'm sorry, I'm siding with Bob here, I've been in ward councils and all that, and in day to day operations of the church, when you're calling a bishop or you're calling a stake president, do you think they're pulling up their patriarchal blessing to see what tribe they're in?
No, I agree with that.
They're interviewing people. Yeah, do you think it'll be good?
But they have the inspiration to know, Randy. I'm surprised you didn't know that.
Okay.
I think this is just summed up in one sentence, that this is just an outward reflection of a systematic way of everyone getting to think that they're special when they're all the same. That's like all this is. It's just like one big farce. It's like we need a system so that the lowest of the low, the highest of the high all have a place and are all special. It means nothing, but it just makes you feel
special.
Yeah,
but the system doesn't exist anymore. I mean, and that's what it, with
look at it this
policy,
way.
With this essay.
If you want to go to heaven, whose name do you have to have on you?
Joseph Smith's.
Christ. Okay, you have to be baptized into the name of Christ, right? If we're all to be Christ-like, then we should treat our names with the same respect we treat his and have our names mean something and have our family mean something.
You know, Christ...
That's the goal.
Christ is a Greek term.
Yeah. So, like, Joseph Smith understood...
So, do you believe this, Mike, really, what you wrote?
Yeah.
No, what right here, we're... So, basically, if this is to be accepted, the essay... Revelation has ceased prior to Spencer W. Kimball. Is that, I mean, that's a an if then? Do you stand by that?
I'm saying those that read it on a surface level, that's what you tend to take away. And that is a load of, I don't think, if you read closer, it doesn't say that, but that's the gist if you just read it loosely.
Well, can I get into your mind here, Mike? So at any point prior to you calling all these people and raising a ruckus, did you ever feel like, well, the brethren are on this extraordinary level and I can't criticize them? I mean, there's that clip of Dallin Oaks saying you can't criticize the brethren even if they're wrong. Where did you
14 principles of following the prophet talk?
Where did you decide, you know what, enough's enough, I'm going to step over the line and I'm going to criticize them. I'm going to go after them and tell them they're wrong on this one.
No, I've read enough biographies and family stories about living with prophets and apostles. They don't claim to be infallible.
No, I mean, we're not talking about infallible, though. I feel like that you're using an extreme analogy there. We're talking about close to infallible, or, you know, like
they're just
perfect.
But at least on the important things.
At least on this issue,
on the important things.
At least on exaltation of a race of people.
But my understanding of Mike's position is that he doesn't think that they received wrong revelation or anything like that. It's this committee that wrote it and that they signed off on it, and they don't really understand what they've done.
But, exactly. But he's also,
that's how I feel.
Yeah, but you're saying that they weren't even inspired when they gave the stamp of approval, right?
Well, it's kind of like when Joseph got the Kinderhook plates. Well, this looks pretty good.
So here's a little background on the Kinderhook plates. While the saints were still in Nauvoo, a group of locals from the nearby town of Kinderhook claimed to have found a set of brass plates with ancient engravings with a recently discovered skeleton. The plates were brought to Joseph Smith, who declared them to be authentic, stating that they contained the history of the descendants of Ham and Pharaoh, and began to translate them. Now, his translation was never published, but for a long time the church maintained that the plates were in fact genuine. However, in 1980, invasive testing of the still existing plates revealed that they were actually a hoax.
On surface level, this looks acceptable. Go with it, you know. But now we find out later that the Kinderhook was bogus, and I'm telling you this essay is bogus.
So, Mike,
so if they clarify this, if the first presidency come out and they clarify and say, nope, we reviewed it, and we actually are now affirming that the first presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve avow that this is what we meant, we really, really, really super tappy 2014 meant it, then what?
I don't know. I'd have to take it from there.
Hey, Mike, are you familiar with the Proclamation Number 2?
Wilford Woodruff. Yes.
What does it say?
Well, there's not going to be polygamy anymore.
No, that the Lord will never allow
two.
His...
Not one, two.
So this Proclamation Number 2, what they're referring to, is from the 61st Semiannual General Conference in 1890, where Wilford Woodruff, which is very hard to say quickly, says, the Lord will never permit me or any other man who stands as president of this church to lead you astray. It is not in the program. It is not in the mind of God. If I were to attempt that, the Lord would remove me out of my place, and so he will any other man who attempts to lead the children of men astray from the oracles of God and from their duty.
Proclamation 2, the Lord will never allow his church to be led astray. If so, he will remove.
Right, correct.
Okay. So, at what point will you draw the line in the sand where the church is being led astray? If you think a committee is leading the brethren astray, what's next?
Spoiler alert. The committee.
It's just an essay.
Do you believe the church will never be led astray?
Yes. Christ leads his church. These are Christ's apostles. That's one of the things that's upsetting is if these are Christ's apostles today, all the ones prior to 78 were Christ's apostles, hand chosen then.
Hey, so Mike,
hang on a second. I gotta ask this, and I know I'm ripping a can of worms open, so let's just cool it before I say this. I'm just saying this is a hypothetical, Mike, so, you know, take a deep breath, brother.
Okay.
Let's just say, hypothetically, that the church, they found a way to be okay with homosexuals. Okay?
I thought I already brought this up.
I know, but let's just say hypothetically, I mean, because we're talking about you having problems with what the brethren approve, Mike. If they did, would your feelings be even more so? Would you make twice as many phone calls? Would you leave the church? I mean, what kind of conflict would be going on in your head there?
It's impossible. It's doctrinally
No. See, you're not entertaining my hypothetical.
So is this. I don't think he understands the word hypothetical.
So just pretend.
Then you hit your knees and say, please send us a new prophet.
Is that what you'd really say?
Yes.
You'd be like, the church is no longer being led by you, God. We're in apostasy.
But you're not to that point on this one yet, right? This is just an essay. You're saying that this is a problem, but it's not. It's just a sleight of hand or a mistake, a clerical error, or, you know, bad judgment call. It didn't stay on the desk long enough before
somebody got happy. Yeah, somebody got happy with the rubber stamp. Yeah,
I sustain the first presidency in the 12th. I just don't sustain this essay.
Is it because Thomas Monson's senile? Do you think that's how they slipped it past
him? No, everybody. You know, I keep hearing rumors like that, and then you see him, and he's just you see him in an interview or up at conference, and he's clear as day. You know.
Who do you think has more authority in the church, Mike, the first presidency or Curtin McConkie, the church's law firm?
aren't they employed by the first presidency?
Yeah, so. who do you think has more influence over the church?
That's like saying who has more influence, the cash register guy at the KFC or the manager in the back?
Oh, nice. I like it.
That was pretty good.
So which one is the cash register in the back?
The lawyers are the cash register.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right now, the guy at the cash register, he's running the show.
But if the attorneys write all the policies and all the, you know, and this is the same thing, the PR.
That's just a sad statement of the day, is that when you have a large church that's global and everything can get picked apart, you have a message to get out, but then you have to run it through legal to avoid all the crazy people in the world that want to throw a lawsuit every time they turn their heads. That's just a sad statement of the day.
But between the law firm and these essay writing committee members and the PR firm, where does the first presidency come in?
Well, they direct. I wanted to say this. You put it in legal language, you know?
That's a problem, isn't it?
That's just a sad state of the affairs.
But is that what they did here, Mike? Except with the lawyers, they did it with the historian, they did it with the committee, and said, "Here's what we want to say. Put it in the proper language, and we'll sign off on it."
They really screwed the language up.
Didn't they commission this?
Yes, they commissioned it.
By the way, for the record, I think Mike is just living in like a pre-correlated state of the church. Like back to Tom's point of like, how can you be challenging? And if you do go back, you know, before David O. McKay, this type of stuff, which doesn't get very much press nowadays because the church has sort of buried it. But if you read real history, I mean, the brethren and even bishops and stake presidents were challenging each other on fundamentals like this all the time. And, you know, there was even wars at the apostle level. And, you know, just look at evolution as an example. I can't remember the apostle's name on either side, but then one over the other.
B.H. Roberts v. Joseph Fielding Smith.
Yes.
Wasn't Talmage involved in that too?
Talmage was on
B.H. Roberts' side, but B.H. Roberts and Joseph Fielding Smith were the two main guys.
B.H. Roberts and James E. Talmage were both on the side of chemistry and geology and supporting evolution as it being a kind of a quasi-evolution that's under God's jurisdiction, versus Joseph F. Fielding Smith, who believed in a literal translation of the Bible and in creationism.
That's fun stuff to read, too. That's enthralling.
So, Mike, do you feel like correlation overall has been like a detriment? Because I feel like it's not your style. It's not the church. Like you're really like Mormonism pre
pre-correlation. I don't mean to like put you in a box, but that's kind of how I think of you. And
that's the most exciting books when you go to like, especially in Utah, they have a lot of the bookstores, and you can find some great stuff if it's printed like pre 1950 or 50s and 60s. There's some good stuff, and it's just the simple gospel, and it's exciting. And then you get into correlation, and it's like we have to simplify everything, but also it's almost like
whitewash it.
Be too careful. Hey, did we ever cover, Mike, if this is doctrinal, how do you reconcile Joseph Smith's time and the fact that he did give blacks a priesthood?
You know, that's, you know, maybe he got a good vibe off of them and these guys are good and go with it. You know, if the whole point was the cultural aspect, you know, are they living in a culture that's priesthood?
Whoa. Cultural what?
It's about family. It's about lineage. It's about family.
Right. A family is a culture. Right,
but if there's an exception to the rule, Mike, then there is no rule. Like on this one, you can't look both ways.
But let's go back to that guy. That guy, you know, Elijah Abel or whomever that we know was given the priesthood. Why the exception? He's still part of that same culture, that lineage that you're talking about.
He's living in Nauvoo among the saints, and he's one of the saints.
Why can't any other black person use the same argument?
Wow. Thank you. No, you know what? I appreciate that, Mike. Thank you for proving our point.
Yeah. Well, what about that Manning lady that was living among the saints in Salt Lake and petitioned to the day she died to just get her endowment?
This Manning lady is Jane Manning James, a free black woman that joined the church in Nauvoo and later crossed the plains with the saints, but was never allowed to actually participate in the ordinances of the temple.
I'm sure she was first in line after 78, and they ran her through the system.
There's a whole book about her. Brigham was a total to her.
Yeah. Joseph Smith was not racist. He was a progressive. For all his foibles, for all his
problems. Don't you foul the name of that great man with calling him a liberal.
Yeah, quit putting him up there.
How dare you, sir? He was a total liberal. He was about free. He was about open sex. I said
he was progressive. He was not a liberal. He was progressive.
Same poisonous language. How dare you, sir?
Poisonous.
That was pretty good.
I think we...
Yeah, we beat this one Mike, to death.
For how much I despise everything you stand for, I can't help but admire you taking on... How many of us? One, two, three,
Listen,
four of us?
I hate Mike online. I hate him. I like the guy in person. I'm gonna be honest.
Who doesn't love Mike?
Who doesn't love Mike? It's true.
You're standing in the middle of the ring while four guys are just kicking you, and you're just like, "Yeah, give me more."
And he won't fall down. We're like, "What's wrong with this guy? Why does he just fall over?"
We'll remember him in your prayers tonight.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
So, now you've listened to it. What do you think?
Well, there are lots of thoughts. Let's start by going through the 3 points, because the first and second point are pretty clearly at the beginning, but the third point is way at the end, and it's hard to remember what's happened, because we go in lots of circles.
Right, right.
So let's start with Mike's point number one, about the language of the statement that the church put out. So... his main issue was the language talking about white privilege and critical race theory and how these are very political words to use.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So with this particular issue, it's kind of hard for me to even understand where Mike is coming from. Because for him to think that white privilege doesn't exist... is just, I don't even know where he could be living. I mean, like, just the other week we have 4 teenagers in Florida, and one of them gets shot because they're listening to loud music. I mean, it's clear that they didn't have a gun. I mean, and it's clear that it's because of their race. I can walk down the street with a hoodie over my head because I'm white and blonde, and it's fine, no one would care. But if there was a black man doing that, people would get nervous, and it's unfair, and it's the white privilege that we all benefit from. I mean, this goes from...
We all being
white people.
We're all white, right? We're white. Everyone listening to this podcast, you're white. I know you are. All of you.
Let's say a majority is probably white.
Yeah, no, that's a fair assertion to make, probably.
I mean, from the history of jail punishments from crack versus cocaine, crack being the substance that, you know, that's typically found in black drug abusers, and then cocaine being the drug the drug that white abusers use. I mean, the jail sentences are very different, even though it's the same substance. So, I mean, it's white privilege is everywhere we are. And someone who doesn't acknowledge that, I mean, that just turned me off at the beginning. He has some other points, but this one is one that I just don't even know how to respond to that.
Right. Well, I think that it's kind of, it really speaks to the conflation of Mormonism, especially in like the post-correlation era, where the conflation of Mormonism with like American conservative political ideals, and which is something I thought was really interesting when they talked about Joseph Smith being a progressive. I mean, if you look at the statement at, you know, the platform that he put out when he ran for president, and a lot of his statements at the time were incredibly progressive, and a lot of people think that where I came from in like rural Arizona, it's kind of seen, it's a brand of Mormonism it's seen that like Mormonism is inevitably like tied to
conservative
political ideals, because like, it's like, oh, well, you know, they didn't want to do Satan's plan, and Satan's plan is big government and liberalism, you know? And so like those get combined a lot, but I think I don't think that it's an inevitable conclusion at all. It's something that kind of sprung up because of, you know, several administrations of presidents of the church were politically conservative, and it just kind of got ingrained in the post kind of 1950s post-correlation era of the church. But, you know,
scared of hippieism.
Right, right. Reaction to hippieism, right. And
sexual revolution.
Yeah, right. Right, right. Feminism, you know, like second wave feminism and that type of thing, like reactions to that. But, you know, for a long period of time, Mormons were actually seen as being, you know, promiscuous and very sexually expressive against the norms of society. I mean, when Mormons practiced polygamy, that's kind of how they were seen, right?
Yeah, there were lots of cartoons in Washington and around the states that depicted Mormons as these, you know, over-sexualized people, you know, since they were, I mean, having sex with more than one person and getting married to more than one person. And it was, you know, seen as okay. It was seen as celestial marriage.
Right.
So it is very interesting how that has kind of been flipped on its head now.
Right, right. It's like opposite. Now we're like kind of this really like white bread, very down home, very sexually conservative image that Mormons put out. But it's weird that, you know, at one period in the church's history, it was the exact opposite. We were fighting we put out the exact opposite image.
Yeah. So that was his first comment about the language that was used. His second comment has to do with the darkening of skin color as not being a theory, but it is in fact a doctrine that is talked about all throughout the Mormon scripture.
Yeah.
So this is a point that he has that, I think most people would agree with him that it's hard to navigate these waters of, you know, what's doctrine, what's not, when does the race card, when can it be played
right
in a religious way, and when can it not? But throughout this conversation, he kind of says, well, if you just use family lines and not race, then it's okay. Mm-hmm. But then later he starts saying, well, it's the culture that the people are born into. So it gets very confusing about what he's actually claiming. And for me, it's very obvious that it's impossible to talk about this without it being racist. Mike would, I mean, you can tell he doesn't want to be called racist. He doesn't consider himself racist. But if you're saying that someone, just because of a family that they're born into, can be judged against simply on that fact, then, I mean, that's the definition of racism. I don't really know how else to think about it.
Right, right. Well, the thing is, like, there's this special stigma against racism that we've really accepted in the United States, which I'm totally a fan of, by the way, right? I'm really glad that it's become that we've accepted it on a cultural level so bone deep that, like, to be called racist is something that nobody wants to do. I mean, some people do, but they're idiots. Like, on by and large, nobody wants to be called racist. But the thing is, there's nothing more... I mean, the only thing wrong with racism... And I never thought I'd say this sentence, but the thing that's wrong with racism is discriminating against a certain group of people for something that's outside of their control. It's having some sort of, because they belong to some group, because of something outside of their control, they're not allowed to do certain things, or they're seen as they're not given full status within the community.
Well, it's also probably not a good idea to discriminate against people for choices that they make. For example, you know, women who want to work or want to have children or want to do both. But it's especially...
Right.
But it's especially unfair to discriminate against people who have no choice about, you know, their gender or their sexual orientation or their... And people can disagree about that.
Right.
But, or their race or... the country that they're born, the land that they're born onto.
Right.
That's something that no one can control. So it's just starting off a kid on a very bad footing.
Right.
To be negative about something like that.
Yeah. And the fact that you say, if you say family, over and over, Mike says, you know, if you replace racism with families, it makes perfect sense. No, it doesn't. It's still screwing somebody over because of something totally outside of their control. That's what's wrong with it. It's not as if, like, there's something especially bad about racism that, you know, if you discriminate against them based on their families, it's okay, just not on their race. I mean, the fact that there is no difference between the two.
Or discriminating...
Ethically.
Discriminating against someone based on their culture. I mean, to me, that just sounds like fear of the unknown. Like someone, oh, well, they're born in a black culture. What does that mean? They listen to different music? They eat different food than you? Like... they weren't ready for the gospel because they have a different culture. Like, I mean, Jesus wasn't white. Like,
well, no,
Jesus lived in a different culture as well.
Like, yeah, I think the implication of that is, like, God is a Western European.
Right.
Right?
And it's, like, that doesn't make any sense.
God descended from colonials or something.
Right. Yeah. So, anyway, that says point number two, which has some validity, but... is also problematic.
Well, that's the thing. I also agree with a lot of... I mean, I really agree with what the point that they made at the end, that they like Mike. I like Mike a lot, too, because he is willing to stand up and say that these things are still doctrines and act as if... And point out the inconsistencies within the accepted doctrines. If you say that the darkening of skin is totally disavowed, those scriptures that we read... they completely endorse that idea.
Right.
And
they validate Mike.
They totally validate Mike. And I think he's totally right in this sense, that it is doctrinal and you can't just say that, chalk it up to racism and still maintain the prophetic mantle and still maintain that the prophets were totally inspired, you know? I don't know. I think it's very hard. It becomes a very slippery slope when you get to that point.
But I also agree with you that just calling it family lines doesn't solve everything.
No.
Like Mike wants to believe that just stop calling it race, just only call it family lines.
Right.
I don't think that really evades the issue.
Yeah, no, I think that morally it's the exact same conundrum,
yeah.
Right? It kind of directly violates that the second article of faith, people won't be punished for their own sins.
Right.
I mean, people will be punished for their own sins. You'll be punished for your sins. Your sins. But
not someone else.
Right, right. But not anybody else's, right? That somehow your descendants won't suffer for your sins or something like that. So.
Right. And so let's go on to the third issue that Mike has, which is that the church is missing a teaching moment. That this principle... of priesthood blessings. I actually really like the way he phrased this, that there's priesthood blessings and priesthood bans, and there's a reason for them, and this is missing a teaching moment.
Mm-hmm.
But this is very tricky, I think, for the church, and I think the other commenters were right, that if they did use this as a teaching moment, it would be socially... very problematic for members. to defend that. But at the same time, coming out with this statement, it's problematic for the doctrine that they've been teaching. So the third one really hits on why all of these statements that the church has been putting out are necessary for a lot of reasons, but also very problematic for the church and difficult.
The statements that we're talking about, just to be clear, are the essays being uploaded on LDS.org about different quote-unquote controversial topics, like the relationship between, you know, DNA studies and the Book of Mormon and polygamy in early Utah history. And
there are about 5 or 6 of these that are out, and we expect, I think there are about 12 that are supposed to be out in total.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a dozen or more that are kind of
slowly being unveiled.
Right, right, in the pipeline.
So, yeah, and we've talked to lots of people about these, the issue and the good part about these statements, and it's a complicated thing for the church to have to deal with.
Right. Right, and I think these discussions, these ethical dilemmas and kind of reevaluating faith and people's base for their testimony is going to continue to happen as these come out. There was a really great article on a blog post that was pinging around the internet for a while about a bishop in New Zealand that was having struggles with his faith because he's reading all of these essays that kind of disavow these ideas, like that, you know, the DNA essay doesn't kind of endorses the idea that the descendants, the indigenous population of the Americas, weren't descended from Israelites. And, you know, that was something that he had told people for a long time. He said, well was I lying? You know,
he felt like he was defending the church and using the church's examples and things that he had learned in church about defending themselves against that argument. And now they're coming out in support of the argument of the DNA evidence. And so he feels betrayed and it's difficult. So
right. And I don't want this this podcast to seem like we're kind of gleefully dancing over the grave of Mormonism, you know, and like cackling for the lost faith of people. But these are real. These issues, I think, are important. They're it's important for people to grapple with these issues intellectually and spiritually and really
navigate through those difficult waters.
Right. And acknowledge that they are difficult and help them be able to kind of, you know, move through it and find a place where they have peace.
Yeah.
So hopefully this was helpful for everybody, and we hope you enjoyed the podcast.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.